You don't have to crawl through space and time in order to get to where you want to be. You can just be where you are and let time flow through you. You remain stationary and time flows through you. And eventually the future that you have in mind will reach you, and you will be ready for it if you stay present and you do your work to improve yourself and be prepared for that future when it arrives.
Welcome to Life with Bitcoin, where we delve into the human side of Bitcoin by focusing on Bitcoiners' personal transformations and life stories. I'm your host, Vivian. Thanks for tuning in. If you like and want to support our mission on shining light on the human side of Bitcoin, remember to subscribe to this channel, leave a comment, or send a few sats from link in the description. Today, our guest is Yoni Appelberg, a medical doctor from Sweden, researching how psychedelics can be best implemented for palliative care. He's also a YouTube creator who makes whiteboard explainer videos about Bitcoin and the ulcer of abundance through scarcity. Welcome, Yoni. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
We met during Bitcoin Atlantis, where both of us have lost our voice. So this is my actual voice, by the way.
And this is mine. Perfect.
This is the first time for me to record an episode at 2 a.m. And I told you how you'll probably get an even more sentimental version of me. So hope you enjoy it.
I already am.
You're a medical doctor. So what does a typical day look like for you?
I wake up. I brush my teeth. I grab my bike and I get to work in 2 minutes. I spend my day at the office and I see a variety of patients. I am a general practitioner, meaning that I do all kinds of things. And here in the rural part of southern Sweden, we get to do a whole lot of things, which is very fun. What I enjoy most is surgery. I think that's most fun. I also like, I think psychiatry is the most exciting and field to explore. And internal medicine is, of course, the basis for everything. So that is where I put my main focus. After work, I finish at 5, I get off at 5, and then I head straight to the gym. Every day, no days off. And then I get home and I write until I get to bed, and then I read for half an hour. That's my days.
I can already see a lot of discipline in this, because every single day at the gym, there's a lot of healing going on a daily basis, and there's a lot of reflection.
I've been injured for quite some time, but I am now in a place where my body allows me to, again, do the things that I want to do with it, which makes me very happy.
I was reading the Four Agreements last week. I finished it last week, and I remember seeing it in one of the agreement is that we have to do our best, and that do our best is not necessarily the same every day. Like on a sunny day, your best is not the same as your best on a cloudy day, or your best today may not be your best yesterday. And it seems so intuitive and easy, but I think it's something that it really struck me at the time as I was reading it. I was like, yeah, you're right. It's about doing our best. But before, like, I already knew that, but before I didn't think about how the best is also a variable on a daily basis. So it's really about, there's a lot of self-acceptance going on in there. So it's good to see that you're getting back to where you were just constantly trying your best, I guess, with your body in the flow state.
You know, there's a story about this 95-something-year-old, 98, 100-year-old guitar player. And sitting on his bed, basically his deathbed, he's still holding his guitar, practicing simple scales and chords. And when asked, why do you still practice? You are 100 years old. You are literally sitting on your deathbed. Why are you still practicing? And the answer came, because I am still improving. And that is the job of human beings. Our job is to continuously improve ourselves. That is what we are as a species. We are self-improving entities. And it should be our sole task in this world to improve ourselves, to improve others, and improve our surroundings, the world. And in order to improve ourselves, we can choose whatever paths that suits us. And as you so insightfully say, Vivian, doing our best to improve ourselves varies from day to day. Somebody who loses his or her health only wants to get better and will do what they can to improve their health. Somebody who is at their peak intellectually, physically, and spiritually has a completely different path. But our paths are ultimately individual, but they also converge, and we have paths on a collective level as a species. That is how we shape civilization, by improving ourselves, improving our minds, and improving our bodies, and then letting the best versions of ourselves contribute to humanity.
I have a similar story kind of along this line. There's a grandma who's at 60 years old, want to learn violin. And she said, oh, I'm already 60. I've wanted to learn violin my whole life, and now it's too late. And then she ended up lived until 90 years old. And then she then regretted and thought to herself, wow, if I started at 60, I would have already played the piano for 30 years. And I guess this is another, like, I get reminded of this all the time. I remind myself when I try to do something and think, oh, it's too late. But I try to remind myself it's not. And it's always better to start today. And, you know, you never know. Maybe you get to do this forever, right? You have to, the best time to plant the tree is 10 years ago. And the second best of time is now. So it's just one of those things.
Yeah, my mom is starting to stack sats now at 65. and I am just starting my calisthenics journey, closing in on 40.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's never too late. And I love how people have different timelines for things. And it's a great comfort to know that everybody has their own timeline for things, for their self-discovery, for their self-transformation. It literally takes a lot of my anxiety away. Like, I'm like the number one person who hates to feel anxious. So this is something that constantly take my anxiety away. Just know that I have my own path, and I don't have to look at everybody else around me or away from me to feel ahead or behind, because it's not about that. We don't need to look horizontally. It's more of a vertical thing, is us versus us on a daily basis. I watched your interview on Bitcoin for Peace with Valerie, and was kind of blown away. I'm a pretty intuitive person. I can usually pick up when people are comfortable wearing their own skin. And I can definitely see you're one of them. And you also seem to be a person who we kind of share that personality with, that are pretty obsessed with the experience of being human and becoming human, in a sense. We'll get into that in a sec. One of the topics that I want to delve into is psychedelics. Can you explain to us what is psychedelics? Like, I'm a 5-year-old, maybe not like a 5-year-old, but without getting technical.
Psychedelics are a group of substances that temporarily alter your state of mind fundamentally. In order to understand what psychedelics are, you have to know that they have pretty loaded political baggage. We used to, so there are four main psychedelics. They are LSD, DMT, psilocybin, and mescaline. These are the four types of psychedelics, and there are synthetic versions also, and they pops up new ones all the time. And then there are other substances that have psychedelic-like qualities, like MDMA and marijuana edibles, for example, ketamine. These are the psychedelics. They are non-addictive substances that are extraordinarily, physically extraordinarily safe. You cannot become addicted to them. You cannot die from them. There's no LD50. LD50 is a pharmacological term that stands for lethal dose 50, which is a metric used in toxicological studies where you give rats a certain amount of the drug or the substance, and you measure where at what dosage 50% of the rats die.
Right.
There is no LD50 for psychedelics. These substances have incredibly transformative powers. In the 1940s and 50s, they were used in psychiatry to treat depression, anxiety, PTSD, and all the kinds of mental disorders that we struggle with today. And they were also used to research consciousness. And they are incredible tools to research consciousness, because in order to understand the human mind, the human brain, and consciousness, it's not enough that we should look at the brain anatomically and physiologically. We also have to understand its functions and what it is capable of generating and or hosting. So if we look at, for example, if we want to study the brain's capacity for language, for example, we would study the Broca's area, which is an area that sits right about here. I'm pointing now to the lateral sides of my forehead. And the Broca's area, they are responsible for speech, the motor component of speech. And then you have Wernicke's area on your temporal lobe. And they are responsible for language comprehension. But it's not enough that you should study these areas physiologically and anatomically to understand language and your brain's perception and use of language. In order to understand your brain's role in language and how it deals with language, how it generates language, how it understands language, you also have to look at poems, at literature, at music, at how the brain perceives beauty in language, how it creates poetry that at certain points in our lives may feel like just creative expressions and a luxury, but when we actually experience loss of a loved one, or when we fall in love, or when we have our hearts broken, it becomes sustenance. If you've ever had that experience of how language can be healing through reading something like Brother Karamazov, or a beautiful poem by Swedish poet Tranströmer, or whatever works for you, you will see that there's you need that as well in order to understand the brain and consciousness. So what psychedelics do in this aspect is that they show us what the brain is capable of perceiving, which is in a radical contrast, in stark contrast to our everyday consciousness. For some people, if you take an heroic dose, as it's called, of any type of psychedelic, and you completely switch out your mental operating system to another one,
right,
you will have a different kind of experience as a human being on this planet, one that you did not know that you could have. And when you are in that place, you have the mental capacity, you have the mental operating system to understand that place. But when you are back in this state, you cannot, because that place is a place beyond language. It is a place beyond your mental capability as when you are in your normal problem-solving state of mind, as you and I are right now. It's so that makes it very difficult when you come back to this state to describe that other state. You can bring back lessons. You can bring back ideas. You can bring back the sensation or the notion that there is other ways of perceiving this world, because right now you and I are interacting with the world through our biological aperture in the forms of our ears, eyes, and senses. And then we have the brain interpreting these signals and generating this world in our heads. So our brains are are reality generating machines. We live in simulations by definition, because what we have right in front of us, this is not base reality. This is created in our minds.
Yeah.
And psychedelics help us see this. So psychedelics in the 1940s and 50s were used to explore consciousness, and these ideas were generated already back then. And they were also very effective at treating psychiatric disorders. Then in the 1960s, sorry, I'm going on a rant here. Then in the 1960s, these substances leaked out into society, and they were adopted by young people who found that the use of psychedelics, they found psychedelics to be so transformative that it formed a new culture that had never existed before in the modern West. This created the Flower Power Movement, as we remember it today, a very chaotic era where people used psychedelics to forge a new path in life and in society. They realized, people using psychedelics in the 1960s realized that the way that the Western world was heading was not the way that was most beneficial to humanity and society. So they said, no, we do not want to be part of your establishment anymore. We are making our own world, and you can be part of it if you want, but we are no longer partaking in your world. We are creating our own. They said no to fighting the wars of the government. They said no to conformity. Because what happened, you know, an unenlightened society promotes conformity. But these people started having spiritual enlightenment. So they, meaning that they began to discover who they really were, and they started to practice self-alignment. And eventually it became impossible to deny who they really were.
Right.
And this was a direct threat against existing power structures. So, and this was a problem for the government. So Richard Nixon in the 1970s, he was a spokesperson against these substances, because young men did no longer want to fight in the Vietnam War. He said that these substances are a public enemy number one, and they must be criminalized, because young men do no longer want to die for their countries. And this was a problem in his view. And it is a problem under our current way of organizing society. And this is a clash between two worlds, basically. So from there came a very, an era of propaganda against psychedelics. And a lot of people still believe and are sadly influenced by this propaganda. The propaganda that this is your brain on drugs, and they show a frying egg,
and people jumping out of the window, staring into the sun until they go blind, all these kinds of crazy stories. But now there's a resurgence of psychedelics. I just received an email this weekend, published the results of a study that I have been waiting for a very, very long time. And this was a study that was going to have the FDA take a stance on psychedelics. And this was a study where LSD was used to treat general anxiety disorder, a generalized anxiety disorder. And the study was conducted for just 12 weeks. But after 12 weeks, we could see about an 80% remission of the generalized anxiety disorder on LSD, which from just one session, one treatment session. The FDA have now, I'm getting goosebumps talking about this, they have now approved LSD as medicine.
Right.
This is a major, major turn of events. This is a major evolution, a major leap in the evolution of modern medicine.
It's a recognition of truth.
It is a recognition of truth. So that is my rant on what psychedelics are. They come in different forms. There's a psilocybin, which is a mushroom. They typically grow on fields under cow dung for some reason. And then there's LSD, which is produced from ergot, another mushroom that grows on rye. And then there's mescaline, which is a cactus found in Central America and Mexico. And then there's DMT, which is the active component, the active component in ayahuasca.
I love how you call our brain the reality generating machine, because I agree. And I oftentimes call myself my own brainwash artist for that very reason, is that I choose to construct my own reality. I'm also a firm believer of the whole simulation theory. And at this point, it's more scary for me to even think about the possibility that this is actually not a game. Like in the way this is, the whole thing, the reality is a game, is way more comforting than the otherwise.
Well, if we live in a simulation, that is somebody, we do live in a simulation, but if we live in somebody else's simulation, that gives us a purpose. Like we exist for a purpose if we are somebody else's simulation. So then you don't have to struggle to find meaning. And as we are currently living through a meaning crisis, that can be comforting to some. I can absolutely see that. But it shouldn't take away from our responsibility of having a human experience to the fullest of our capacity.
I believe everyone that comes to our lives with their mission, and they come to fulfill that mission. And when they've done it, is the time that they leave. So when we lose someone in our lives, it's not goodbye. It's a completion. It's a completion of we as ourselves. Is completion of our mission in their lives is also the completion of their mission in our lives.
Yeah, two things on that. First of all, on goodbyes. When it comes to goodbyes, goodbye is something that only serves a purpose when you don't have a spiritual bond with a person. Because when you have a spiritual bond with a person, there's no need for a goodbye. Because there's no separation. There's never any separation. And I have basically discovered now in my adult life that I know of at least three people, possibly four, that are my true soulmates, in the sense that they are, I feel that we have the same soul, meaning that if we say that we are spirits visiting this planet, having a human experience, we are either one and the same going together, or we are some kind of cosmic partners going through different realms and having different experiences. This is not something I believe to be a fact, but it is something that
It is a feeling that I cannot deny exists. And you can have different definitions of what a soulmate is, or your soul friends. But finding these people, when you find these people, you know that goodbyes are never necessary, because the bond cannot be broken. It always exists between you.
There's some sort of entanglement happens.
Sure, you could call it that, I suppose.
I've almost given up on the pursuit of meaning voluntarily, in the sense that I find the mere fact of existence meaningful enough.
I have a fairly stochastic view of life. I think life is very chaotic and it lacks inherent meaning. Meaning is what we give it. And the that's not a trivial thing to say. That doesn't mean that meaning doesn't exist. Well, it doesn't mean it exists inherently, but that doesn't matter, because it exists subjectively, and that is the only way meaning can exist. And that also makes it stochastic and chaotic, which is beautiful in itself.
Exactly.
So I think it was Brian Cox that said, the physicist and astronomer, I think it was he who said that, imagine our world leaders. They have the power to, as humanity has developed nuclear weapons, our world leaders essentially have the power to exterminate an entire civilization, our entire planet, at least send us as far back as to the Stone Age, and possibly exterminate the human species. And imagine then, if we are the only species of our level of consciousness and intelligence in the entire Milky Way. If that is the case, our world leaders have the capacity to terminate meaning in an entire galaxy. They have a cosmic responsibility. So I do not trust world leaders who have not done 12 sessions of ayahuasca. With the power that they have, I think it should be mandatory to do 12 sessions of ayahuasca. If you have access to nuclear weapons, you need to do 12 sessions of ayahuasca.
Is there a specific reason why it's 12? Statistically significant.
I want them to have breakthroughs, and I think it's impossible to not have breakthroughs if you do 12 sessions.
You got to experience psychedelics fairly late, I heard, until you're in your 30s. So if you were in a thought experiment, if you were to get involved or introduced to psychedelics earlier, say in your early 20s instead of early 30s, how do you think it would have affected you differently?
Psychedelics are one of those things that if you use them for a spiritual purpose or for self-improvement, I think that it's more common that they sort of find you rather than that you go look for them, because you have to be ready for them spiritually and mentally when you start going down that path. I was not in my 20s. I am a late bloomer in every aspect of life. I've never rushed through life, and it has worked out quite well to just be present and don't have the notion that you have to sort of do something to get to the future. You don't have to crawl through space and time in order to get to where you want to be. You can just be where you are and let time flow through you. You remain stationary and time flows through you. And eventually the future that you have in mind will reach you, and you will be ready for it if you stay present and you do your work to improve yourself and be prepared for that future when it arrives. If I would have started my journey earlier,
it's natural that I would have gotten farther, but it's not something that I can't think about. It's kind of the same idea that, like, imagine if I would have found Bitcoin.
I knew you were going to say that. Do you believe psychedelic is something like Bitcoin, where the sooner you get it, the better? Because when we have seen something, when we have revealed the world through a specific lens, we cannot unseen it. Can you be not ready? Is there a way? Can it really backfire in a traumatizing way and hurt us when you're introduced to it under whatever circumstances? Seeing the wisdom, we're seeing the information that you're not supposed to see. Do you believe in such argument, or you think that when you get into psychedelics, you must be ready, and it's a journey that always for the better?
So you're talking about Peter Schiff. Bitcoin is an economic psychedelic. It's a mild one, but it is an economic psychedelic. And some people are never ready to experience psychedelics and embrace them. And I think it's the same with Bitcoin. And for sure, psychedelics can absolutely be damaging to you, not physiologically, but psychologically, because you can see things and have experiences that you don't have the resources to deal with. And when you peer through the veil of reality, peer beyond your biological aperture to see what lies beyond, and you have an experience of the world that is radically different from anything that you even thought could be possible, and you have a mystical experience about the nature of reality, it's not for the faint of heart. It really isn't. And when it comes to Bitcoin, I mean, some people are just not ready to wake up spiritually, financially, and in any way. It's the line from the Matrix, you know, that after a certain age, it can be harmful to wake up another person because the brain has ossified. It has become too rigid to wake up. And when we want to orange pill people who may not be receptive to Bitcoin, it can backfire in the sense that they double down on their pre-existing ideas and their notion of the world just becomes more ossified. Their ideas become more ossified, and it has the opposite effect. And we have essentially made them more fiat than they were before.
Knowing what you know and throughout your journey in the Bitcoin space, if you have to choose three words to describe the collective group of Bitcoiners, what would those be?
Free thinking, open-minded, empathetic individuals. Bitcoin is as many different things as there are individuals. Well, a lot of people think that the blockchain is the base layer of Bitcoin, but it isn't. Bitcoin is the blockchain is layer one, but layer zero is the people. You and I running the nodes, communicating, exchanging value, exchanging ideas. We are the base layer of Bitcoin. And we have we come to Bitcoin with a lot of different backgrounds. For some, Bitcoin is a tool for freedom. For some, it's a savings tool. For others, it's something that spurs a spiritual awakening. Bitcoin has many different effects on different kinds of people. Bitcoin meets you where you are, if that makes sense. Like, you can, as a person, you can only meet somebody else as far as you've met yourself.
Yes.
Does that make sense? And
you can only interact with Bitcoin from where you already are. So if you are a person who is already on a spiritual journey, then Bitcoin can complement that journey for you and help you wake up in different aspects of your life, and not just spiritually, but also financially, and peer beyond the matrix jobs, the fiat jobs, and the way that the whole entire Western world is organized. And see that there are other ways of doing the world, because we've been living with these narratives that have become a truth, because we've told these stories about how the world works and how the economy needs to work for so long that they have become ingrained in society to the point that they have become truths. For example, state control over money is one of those things that we have told for so long that they have become truths. The story goes that we need a state to control and issue money in order for money to have value and to work. And this is true because it is the story that we have told, and we have shaped and we have forged the economy in that direction because we've told that story. Then Satoshi comes along and says, I have a different idea about this. And Bitcoin shows us that we can actually separate money and state. And I'm not talking about separating fiat and money. Those are inextricably linked. They cannot be separated. So in order to separate money and state, we have to create a different economic operating system, an entirely different kind of operating system for the entire world. We reboot the entire world economy with a different kind of system. That is the process that we are in right now. And to see that this is even possible is an idea so radical that it borders on a psychedelic insight. There are other stories about the economy that have become truths because we told them for so long, like inflation. Like the story goes that we need a certain amount of inflation in order for the economy to continue to operate as we want it to operate, and to shield the economy against harmful deflation. But when we introduce a monetary system with based on absolute mathematical scarcity, with a monetary supply that cannot be debased, there's 21 million bitcoins and there will never be more. And this is the entire pie of tokens that will represent the entire world economy. And as individuals, as corporations, as nation states, as organizations, we will each hold a fixed percentage of that entire pie. And your sliver of that pie will grow with the economy. And this is an idea that the fiat system cannot recognize. It's beyond its capacity to understand. Bitcoin is an economic psychedelic in the sense that it holds up a mirror to the economic system and exposes its flaws in the very same sense that psychedelics do to you. When you ingest psilocybin, it will drag you through hell and back and show you exactly what is wrong with your way of thinking, your way of responding to your situation and your life. And you will be shown the flaws of your reasoning, of the stories that you carry with yourself in your life. If you have a story that is very limiting, like I've for the longest time have had the story that I cannot follow some of my dreams. Like I could never become an author. I could never find love. And these are stories that are very deeply ingrained in me. And psychedelics have shown me that these are just stories that I tell myself about myself. And as I tell these stories to myself, I make them ingrained in my brain to the degree that they become my truths. Because your reality is basically a reflection of your mind. And if your mind is filled with stories that are harmful to your success and your happiness, then you are bound to become unsuccessful and unhappy.
Right.
So what psychedelics do is that they introduce entropy into your brain so that you gain the plasticity to actually change these stories when you see that they exist and that they can be changed. So the analogy is the Snow Hill analogy, which is, it's a famous and very powerful analogy. So you can picture your mind as a snow hill and your thoughts and behaviors as sleds going downhill. And these sleds, your thoughts and your behaviors, they carve grooves in the snow. And the more that you go down these particular paths, the deeper the grooves become. And eventually it becomes increasingly difficult to deviate from those thoughts, thought patterns and behavioral patterns. Yeah. So you cannot explore any other territory in your cognitive landscape because you only have those paths. But psychedelics come in like with a fresh layer of snowfall, and now all of a sudden you have an option where you didn't before. You can now explore new territory in your cognitive landscape. You are no longer shackled to your faulty algorithms of your brain and to your past. So you give yourself a blank slate with enough plasticity of the brain to create new stories and to become a new person.
Right.
To become the person that you want to be. And this is what Bitcoin does for the economy as well. It comes in as with a fresh layer of snowfall onto the stories, onto the economic hill of the world, if you will, and lets us try different paths to change our stories about how the economy should work. Like state control and inflation. These things are relics of the past stories of how the economy should operate. But they're not very enlightened. And psychedelics give us, Bitcoin as an economic psychedelic, gives us these enlightenments about how the world can actually operate.
You remind me of a conversation I recently had with a friend. And the sentiment I was left to meditate with was, what is the self? It's not what we think we are. It's not what other people think who we are. It is what we think what other people's are in our eyes. It's the others in our own eyes. Seems like Bitcoin and psychedelics offer us this lens to view not only ourselves differently, but more importantly, the world around us. A pair of fresh fresh eyes, refreshing and leading us, giving us new perspectives. This is Life with Bitcoin. I'm your host, Vivian, and we'll see you in the next episode.